You're listening to a proud member of the Dice Tower Network, dedicated to bringing podcasters together for the greater good of gaming. It's sort of like Voltron, but with better lip syncing. Find out more at dicetowernetwork.com.
Hello and welcome to episode 186 of the Family Gamers Podcast.
Wow, you did that differently than normal.
Yeah, I did.
Hello, everybody.
Caught off guard.
It is episode 186 of the Family Gamers Podcast. As it happens, I still have a fact or two about the number 186.
Do you really?
I do. Did you know that the number 186, the 186 is a legendary six-cylinder Holden engine that was first used in the Holden HR series? It has a piston displacement of 186 cubic inches.
Hence the 186.
Exactly. Also, right. It's been 186 years since I've last left my house.
It does kind of feel that way, doesn't it?
I think March is the longest year I can remember.
Yeah. Pretty much.
Hello, everybody. We are going a little bit stir crazy, I think. We may have a cabin fever. We've got cabin fever.
We're flipping our bandanas. Been stuck at home so long that we have simply gone bananas.
All right. But nonetheless, we have this amazing opportunity to come out of our shells and talk to our listeners. Thank you so much for listening to the Family Gamers Podcast. It means so much more than I can possibly express. Hello, everybody. As always, I am your host, Andrew, and I am joined by my lovely and wonderful wife, Anitra.
That's me.
This episode of the Family Gamers Podcast is sponsored by First Move Financial.
The U.S. stock market is officially in a bear market now. What that means is that stocks have fallen more than 20% from their recent highs. How does this change the advice First Move is giving? Not much. If you're in an industry that may be hit by the current downturn, like the airlines or hotels or oil and gas, you may want to beef up your emergency fund. Specific investment advice is more case by case, but generally, try not to panic. If you need to have a quick chat to assuage your fears of the market, reach out to First Move through the meeting link at firstmovefinancial.com/familygamers.
Thank you to First Move Financial for sponsoring this episode of the show. What are we going to talk about this week? I'm sure nobody here is surprised to hear that being stuck at home with our kids has been on the forefront of our minds lately.
Yeah, like many families all around the world at this point, we've been suddenly pushed into doing some kind of homeschooling with our children.
Yeah, it's been really interesting, especially for us, because we don't have a ton of support from the school system quite yet. They're working on it, but they just haven't done it yet. They haven't gotten there.
I mean, we have a lot of benefits in that Andrew and I were already home all day anyway, but even with that, it's still a scary time. It's not any easier if you're trying to juggle your kids' needs with also working from home. But there is hope, and we're making this show as much for the two of us as we are for you guys.
Yes, so thank you very much for the therapy. We appreciate it.
And we want to talk this week about what do you do with your kids home all day? What are you going to do to support their education and not just let them play video games 20 hours a day?
So we've talked before on a couple of different podcasts about the concept of board games as education. We've talked about game schooling with Chrissy. We talked about board games as education with the Board Gaming with Education folks. We had Brant Sanderson, who is a teacher,
He's a math teacher who uses games
on the show, who uses games in his classroom. So we've talked about this topic a little bit, but we really wanted to develop this a little bit more, and not just in an education context, but really how board games can fit into your schedule when you're stuck at home with your kids, both for a schooling thing and also just as a way to get through the day.
Yeah.
It's very different when you talk about having time to have some fun and going to play a board game versus using board games deliberately as part of your daily life / coping mechanism / whatever. You can think about this kind of like the difference between being assigned a book to read versus reading a book for fun.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to look at it.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes even the same book feels a whole lot different when someone's telling you you've got to read it. Yep. So we don't want board games to become a burden, even if they're being used in an educational context. And so that's kind of what we wanted to talk about this week, I guess.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to stick wholly to board games, but you know us. That's always our focus on this show.
Absolutely. So, of course, that's not what we do first on this show.
Right. First, we're going to talk about what we've been playing.
What we have been playing. Now, Anitra's list is like a CVS receipt.
Yeah, guess what? It's longer than usual because I'm home with my children and not enough other things to do.
But my list is only slightly longer than normal because I actually have to work all day.
You still work all day, yes.
I mean, you work all day too, just by playing board games sometimes.
Sometimes.
Yeah. So I'm going to go first. And the first game on my list is a game that I had played before and you had never played before. And I was really excited to show you because I liked it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And this was Animal Kingdoms from Galactic Raptor Games.
Spoiler, I really liked it a lot too, once you showed it to me.
Yes. So Animal Kingdom is a tableau building influence game. I don't really know.
Yeah.
I have no idea what category to put this game in.
It is definitely an area control, area influence.
It is an area control game. Yes, that's
game.
Right.
Yeah, but the way that you add influencers to an area is not through Instagram, but it's by playing cards that fit the specific requirement for that area. And part of what makes Animal Kingdoms interesting is that there's a whole deck of cards that are the requirements for the various areas, and you pull them out at random.
Yeah, it totally changes. So there are five areas on the board, each one with a different number of, I'm going to call them influence slots. You can think of these as like positions for soldiers or something like that. And the way that you play your cubes, your influence cubes, into these spots is by playing a card that fits the requirements of that area. And these requirements can be anything from it has to be a 1 or a 2, or it has to be a 4 or a 5, to it has to be one rank greater or less than the previously played card, or it has to be the same beast as one of your neighbors, or it can't be the same beast as anything else that's currently the active beast on the board, or any of these other things. So the cards have animals on them, and you can kind of think of these different kinds of animals as suits.
Yeah, and the illustrations are gorgeous, by the way. All of the animals look fairly realistic, but they're also all wearing jewelry, which I mean, I kind of love that touch.
They look realistic, but there's definitely some stylization happening there.
Yeah, yeah. So but they're not like cartoony.
Yeah, so the cards range from 1 to 8, and they have these different animals on them as the suits, basically.
Yeah.
And so when we talk about different beasts, we're talking about the different animals that represent the suits. When we're talking about different ranks, we're talking about the numbers 1
the number.
Through 8.
Yeah.
And so there's this deck of small, like, half-size cards that are always shuffled up and dealt out for each round, and so it's always different.
Yeah, I thought that was really cool. I also like that with area control in general, you can pretty much see what's happening and who's trying to control a specific area, and you can do that calculus. Does it make sense for me to even try? You know, or if I put one more in here, do I gain a insurmountable lead?
Yeah, and there are ways to build up your influence such that you can have influence carrying on from to the next round and the round after that.
Correct. You can only do that with one of the five areas per round, though, which is a nice touch.
Mm-hmm. So we played this game at 2 players and then at 3 players. And I was really pleased that the dynamics of the game didn't really change that much. And it still felt just as back and forth at 3 players.
Yeah, it really did. And that was definitely a nice...
Yeah, I think the game supports 4 or 5. I don't recall off the top of my head. But other than some slight strategic changes, I think this game is going to continue to play well at those player counts.
Yeah.
So that is Animal Kingdoms from Galactic Raptor Games. Had a lot of fun with that game.
So we pulled out King Domino Duel to get one more play in before we recorded the Snap Review last week.
You can check out that Snap Review by going to thefamilygamers.com, or it'll be included in the break for this show.
And then... the other children who were not involved in playing King Domino Duel said, hey, we want to play a game too, and pick My First Stone Age. It was fun playing this with a little bit more mix of kids than usual. It wasn't just a really little kid and me,
sure,
or 2 adults and a really little kid.
Mm-hmm.
And the strategy involved of the combination of you're doing memory, but you're also doing set collection. I really, really like it. And it doesn't feel overly complicated, but there's kind of a lot going on for a kid's game.
So I'll ask you this question, because I haven't played My First Stone Age in a while. So we have now actually played proper Stone Age, which is a very nice, robust worker placement game.
Yes.
Right. Now that you have played Stone Age,
mm-hmm.
do you feel like My First Stone Age does a good job of representing what Stone Age is? Because to me, it's a completely different game.
Yeah, it just not really.
To have it's, the same skin on.
It's themed the same way, but it's not really the same sort of thing because you don't get to pick.
Yeah, that, and that
where
was
you're
my
putting
feeling.
Your guy.
That was my feeling, and so
you kind of do, but
yes,
you mostly don't.
Stone Age is a good game. My First Stone Age is a good game, but really, they're not really connected.
They don't share a
really,
whole lot
in any
yeah.
way. All right, so that was My First Stone Age.
We also tried out 5-Minute Marvel.
Yes, we did. A lot of times.
So many times.
So this was a game, I don't remember why, but for some reason, I had it in my head that I had this Amazon gift card, and I really wanted to get something that I could do with Asher, our 9-year-old.
Yeah, and he had played 5-Minute Dungeon at some previous time.
He played
and
it
enjoyed
at a Con Hard game night. Somebody had brought 5-Minute Dungeon, and he really, really liked it. And, okay, either he said 5-Minute Marvel to me and didn't want to admit it, or I heard 5-Minute Marvel.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. But anyway, so I asked him what he wanted me to get with this $25 gift card, and I ended up ordering through whatever mechanism, Amazon, 5-Minute Marvel, which is the Marvel-skinned version of 5-Minute Dungeon.
Mm-hmm. And once we got over the initial reticence of, oh, man, I'm not sure this is actually the game I wanted to play, he loved it. And we've pretty much loved it, too.
Yeah, I love the fact that it's 5 minutes. I mean, it's not a bad game, and I don't not enjoy playing it, but I can look at it and say, okay, we've got 10 minutes. Okay, we can play this.
We yeah. can play.
Yeah.
Yeah. We've even played with our 5-year-old a couple of times, because obviously he sees everybody else playing and having fun. He wants to play, too. We pick one of the heroes that has a fairly easy-to-understand superpowered deck.
Yep.
Because there is a little bit of reading in that part. So we're like, okay, we'll look through the 10 cards in the hero deck and say, here are the things that might come up if you pull from here.
Yep.
And otherwise, we go for it. The thing I have appreciated the most about 5-Minute Marvel is this is a game where it's timed, but because it's cooperative and because everybody kind of has their part to play, but unless you get really stuck, you're not dependent on other people, it's resulted in a lot less arguing than a lot of games that we play with all of the children.
I really just like how dynamic this game is in the sense that you can really play it at a lot of different ages because it's ultimately just a symbol matching game.
Right. I mean, we've gotten stuck a few times where nobody has the symbol they need. And once you've got more than 2 players, you do want to choose your superhero powers carefully because at more than 2, if you get stuck, it can get very hard to get unstuck.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So you need to make sure that there's somebody out there who can just auto defeat a guy, or there's somebody out there who can discard cards and make somebody else draw more cards.
Yeah,
things
absolutely.
Like that to get the symbols out there that you need.
Yep, I agree with that. Yeah, it's really nice that in a $20 game, there's so much variability and replayability. I think they're worth yeah. like 12 heroes, much higher number than I expected.
It's about 12 heroes. There were definitely spots in the box for more, so I assume they must sell some kind of expansion
I'm
to
sure
it.
I'm sure there is.
But there's also 6 bosses to fight, and each one of those bosses has its own difficulty level and things like that. So you can really dial in the difficulty of the game you want to play, or you can start at level 1 and treat it kind of like a very short campaign game. And see how far you can get into the bosses before you run out of time and have to stop. We have 30 minutes to play. Let's see how many rounds we can get in and how many of these guys we can stop.
There is no expansion at this time, but you're saying that there's slots in the box for sure for more stuff?
Oh, for sure.
Cool, cool. So that is 5-Minute Marvel from Spin Master. Like I said, it's like under $20. I think it's like 19 something on Amazon right now. Very inexpensive. $18.04 even.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So that is a great fun game. If your kids like superheroes, it's stylized to be much more fun. It's not the gritty kind of darker stuff.
Yeah, definitely.
It's great.
The flavor text on all the little enemies that pop up is awesome. And the amount of detail that went into the pictures is fantastic. I just wish that in the middle of playing the game, we actually had time to look at those things.
Yeah. Yeah,
but
I get it.
Actually, it's really interesting. One of the heroes, Squirrel Girl, has a special card that you might draw that then says defeat the next enemy card, whatever they call them, that has a squirrel on it. And that gets you to start looking and being like, wow, something like 25% of the cards in here have squirrels on them somewhere in the picture. Yeah.
There's a couple other ones that have references like that as well. I think there's one for destroy any card that has a ninja in it or something like
that.
So there's a lot of really nice hidden stuff in a lot of the art. They do a great... It's just that production value is just really nice. And
it's really well made.
It's good. Yeah. It's good. So yeah, so that is 5-Minute Marvel from Spin Master.
All right, so that one's awfully frantic. Let me talk about two games we played that are on the other end of the scale and much more calm and peaceful.
Mm-hmm.
I got in a couple solo plays of Hex Roller, which I hadn't pulled out for a while. That was really nice on one of the early days of quarantine to just be calm. I also tried Everyone Loves a Parade with two of our children. Mm-hmm. I will say, I think I like it best in like a 3-4 player range, even though it goes anywhere from 2-6. Because at 2, it's just a little bit too tight back and forth. Like you don't get that feeling of you're actually going to make a parade. And at 5 and 6 players, it gets kind of long and unwieldy. But at 3 and 4 players, it's nice. There's strategy. There's some uncertainty. Am I going to get the parade float I'm going for or not? But overall, a much more enjoyable experience. And it felt very calm. You're just adding, you know, balloons and flags and flowers to your float.
So you've found the therapeutic nature of the parade float.
Yeah, our kids still don't love it. I think it's partly the theme. It's just not their thing.
Well, again, and I know I said this before, we're not really a parade family.
Yeah.
So I can't really blame the theme for falling a little bit flat in that regard. I want to talk about another game that I got a chance to play, and I don't think you've actually had a chance to play this yet, and this is Catacombs of Karak.
Oh, I did. After you played it, a child pulled me aside and said, Mom, you have to play this. So I did.
Yeah, so this is a game, if you want to look it up on BGG or wherever, you can try looking it up as Karak, K-A-R-A-K. I think the Catacombs of Karak is a renaming of this game as it was brought to the States.
Something like that. I don't know.
So this is a game from Outset Media. They're, I'm guessing, newer to the American market. I found them at New York Toy Fair. This is basically my first dungeon crawl. So you start out, all of your characters are on a central tile, and you just explore in various directions, and you keep pulling dungeon tiles and placing them. And if you pull a room tile, you then also pull, I don't know, an encounter tile, I don't know what you would call them, and put it on top. Those tiles could be treasures, they could be monsters, or one or two other things. There's not a ton of different stuff. It's like,
it's
5
mostly
different
monsters.
Yeah. It's mostly monsters. There's like 5 different monsters, and the monsters have a number on them. And all you have to do is roll the 2 dice, and if your dice add up to higher than that number, you have defeated that monster, and you flip it over and you get whatever's on the other side. That's as simple as it gets.
Mm-hmm.
There are asymmetric player powers, so each player has very slightly different abilities.
Yeah, things like one player has the ability to roll equal to or higher.
Which actually, you know what, is kind of a lame ability compared to some of the other ones.
It is, but it's very useful.
Yep.
Another player has an ability to heal a little bit more easily. Another player can walk through walls if there are already revealed rooms beyond the walls.
Mm-hmm. And the goal of the game is to continue exploring this dungeon, over time picking up items and these kinds of things, until someone finds and defeats the Red Dragon. So you can get up to 2 weapons, and weapons can have a strength up to 3, and you simply add that number to your die
roll. To your die roll.
So if you get 2 axes, you're adding 6 to your die roll, which pretty much makes you unstoppable.
Just about, yeah.
Yep. There's a few other things like healing rooms and things like this. So if you roll your dice and you do not defeat a monster, if you roll the same number, you bounce off of them, and that's fine. If you roll less, you take a hit point of damage. Everybody has, I think, 5 points
that
of
sounds right.
health
yeah.
that they can suck, I guess. And yeah, it's a very straightforward, basic game. The kids understood it immediately. I cannot more highly recommend this game as a entry-level dungeon crawl kind of
game. And as a parent, this is a game that does not strictly require reading. As long as one person playing can read, you all can play. And once kids have played it 1 or 2 times, they'll know what the different symbols mean and what the different enemy powers are, and they probably won't need your help with the little bit of reading anymore.
Yep. I mean, each player has 2 abilities, right? So
right.
It's not that hard to remember. It's just not. So I just pulled it up on Amazon. It is $27 on Amazon.
And I want to mention that for Kerak, in addition to the minimal reading required, there's these very nice little two-layer player boards so that everything slots right in. So there's never a question of how many hearts do you start with? There's five, because there's slots for five hearts. How many weapons can I hold? Two. It's right there on the player mat. How many potions can I hold? How many keys can I hold? It's all right there. And once you put a tile in that slot, that's it. The slot is covered until you use that item or have to flip over that heart to a little skull. Anything like that.
Yeah, I think I first saw this with Scythe, and I immediately fell in love with this two-layer board thing. I love it so much.
I've seen it done well, and I've seen it done not so well.
Okay.
But this is a great example of doing it just really well. Everything is there on the board. It takes all that cognitive difficulty away from you. You don't have to think about, where do I need to put this? How much of this do I need? It's all right there.
Well, and look, I mean, this is a game for 2 to 5 players, 7+. It says 45 minutes on it. Odds are pretty good that kids are going to knock these boards a tiny bit and jiggle them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like the worst thing in the world when you have a board with a bunch of stuff laid out and you barely touch it and your stuff goes flying.
Mm-hmm.
With this double layer thing, like, you barely touch it and your stuff just jiggles.
Everything is still in place.
Yep.
I mean, same is not true of the board you're building up on the table, that's, tile by tile.
That's true. But, I mean, there's no way to hold those in place.
Right.
So that is Catacombs of Kerak from Outset Media. $28 on Amazon. We'll have a link in the show notes. We are really enjoying this game.
Yes.
It's definitely something that all of us can play. We all enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
5-year-old all the way up to 38-year-old. We're old.
I'll probably talk more about this later, but we played a game of 10 Days in the USA.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We also played our other new game from Outset Media, Keys to the Castle.
Yes, we did.
This made me think of Corridor or Chinese Checkers in that you're trying to get your guy over to the opposite side of the board.
So Keys to the Castle is a, and I want to say it's a 6x6.
The size of the grid depends on how many players.
Ah, gotcha. Okay. I only played it the one time.
Yeah.
So it's a grid of these tiles, which are all these locked doors, and you are drawing a card and playing a card and drawing a card and playing a card, and each person starts on a different edge of the board, and their goal is to get to the other side. And so, yes, much like a game like Corridor, you have the opportunity to either play a card to attempt to, like, unlock a door or saw through some bars.
Yeah, use a hacksaw to saw through bars.
Or open an additional lock or whatever to move yourself forward, or throw things down, like extra locks or like nets to slow down your opponents.
Or even just relock doors.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's it. That's the game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the kind of game that gives you a framework for what you need to do. And then all the strategy is in your head and between you and the other people.
Mm-hmm. It's an incredibly simple game. This is another game from Outset Media. You can get that one online for about $15. Not bad.
All right. Let's race through a couple more. We got in a couple plays of Lots, which I'm really enjoying. I'm really glad we backed the Kickstarter for that. We also finally pulled out one of the games from our Shelf of Shame, or Shelf of Opportunity, if you were, which is The Kids of Carcassonne. I think you posted this one to Instagram, too.
I did. I mean, it was really fun to watch our 5-year-old and our 9-year-old play this game and realize that this game is older than both of them.
Yeah, it was kind of adorable that way. I mean, because it is still a modern hobby kids game, but it's been a lot of fun to play, and it's an excellent introduction to modern hobby board gaming for younger kids. It's super simple, but it feels like Carcassonne, which is awesome. Elliot, the 5-year-old, also pulled out Heist and asked if everybody would play with him. We are still actually really enjoying that.
I gotta say, for some kind of, I don't know how to describe it, almost like a kitschy talking box.
It is so gimmicky, but it's gimmicky in the same way that, like, a Bop It is gimmicky, in that you want to play it a bunch of times and then you're like, okay, I'm done with this for a while, and it can sit on the shelf for a little while, and then you'll pull it out again later.
Yep. Heist is one of those games that has definitely been of interest for Common Hour Game Night.
You should definitely bring it once we can start the game nights back up again.
Yeah, once we're allowed to touch things without spreading the death virus.
In the interest of getting my children to work together, I also pulled out Suspend Junior at one point.
Mm-hmm.
That was the nobody could agree on a game, so I was like, fine, I will pick something completely different, which worked out surprisingly well. And we also played Sushi Roll, which we'll be reviewing real soon.
We will.
And Mountains. The more I play Mountains, the more I'm liking it.
I like a game that is competitive without being bloodthirsty competitive.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Competitive, but you have to cooperate to get ahead.
Yep. And that's the game.
Yeah. Now I'm at the end.
All right, awesome. So we are going to take a break. When we come back, we are going to talk about how we can manifest education at home that is, I don't know, board game adjacent.
Yeah, sounds about right.
We'll be right back.
And create the most powerful kingdom.
Sway dignitaries to your side and gather favor from wizards to rule your kingdom wisely.
This is a snap review for King Domino Duel.
King Domino Duel is a two-player dice drafting game that leans heavily on the scoring and drafting mechanics from the game that you probably already know, King Domino.
Unsurprisingly, King Domino Duel was designed by Bruno Cathala and Ludovic Maublanc, the same people who designed King Domino, and published by Blue Orange.
Let's talk about how to play King Domino Duel. This is a roll and write.
Yeah, with dice drafting.
Mm-hmm. So instead of pulling dominoes out of a box like in regular King Domino, King Domino Duel is played by rolling dice. One player rolls the dice and chooses one. The second player then chooses two of the remaining three, and the first player gets the one remaining die.
Both players then use their dice to create a domino to draw into their kingdom, following the normal King Domino placement rules. It has to touch either the castle in the center or another domino.
Die faces that have X's on them in the corner work a lot like crowns, and you mark those off as you play.
Yeah, they add a multiplier to your whole connected domain of the same style of shield. But here's something new. Die faces without an X gain you favor towards spells in a central spellbook. The first player to fill in all the spots next to a given spell gets that benefit. The other player can't use it at that point.
Yeah, so these are one-time special abilities. So one of them is, for example, splitting up your two dice so that you can put one part of a domino in one place and the other part in another place. Or another special ability lets you take two dice first, if you're the roller, instead of taking one and then letting the other player take two and taking the one that's left.
One of the more rare abilities lets you turn any one die to whatever face you want. There are also two abilities that you must do immediately, but which don't take effect until the end of the game. One of these is to immediately add another X somewhere in your kingdom. The other one is to pick a domain that's a certain type of shield. At the end of the game, you'll then get three bonus points for each domain of that type.
So this actually rewards you for having a bunch of small separate domains, which is normally a terrible thing in King Domino.
Correct. However, it only works if you actually get the spellbook ability.
This is true. There's also an extra one-time ability that everybody has, which is after you draw your die domino, you can add an X to one of those two dominoes and color in the parapet on your castle. You can do this one time.
Only one time.
Yep. Scoring works just like King Domino. Multiply the X's in a domain by the number of shields in that domain. Add them all up for every domain. Add your special abilities, those rare abilities that we talked about before.
Yeah.
And whatever your total points are, that's your points for the game.
So that's how you play King Domino Duel. It wraps up once neither player can write in any more dominoes.
So what do we think of this game? I think both of us felt the same way when we first started. It seemed okay, but it wasn't really earth-shattering.
Yeah, I wasn't really impressed by it at first because it's more complex than King Domino because of all the spellbook options. And it didn't really seem more interesting, at least at first.
Yeah, the rulebook didn't help a lot. It looked like a simple game. And of course, we all have in our heads King Domino. This game is simple. It's supposed to be simple. And it just didn't really seem that way.
In part because they introduced a lot of new terms when they didn't necessarily need to. This idea of a domain because you're drawing in shields instead of a territory type, not very helpful.
I think maybe they needed to lean a little bit harder into the fact that they were using the King Domino IP. It probably would have made people a little bit more comfortable, and if they used some of that same terminology, it just would have helped out.
Yeah. That said, King Domino Duel is far more luck-dependent than the original King Domino. You're still drafting, it's still a random pull, but now it's dice, so your odds of any given combination coming up are pretty much the same every roll.
Yeah, we talked a lot about how they did an incredible job with the original King Domino, where they weighted things really well, depending on the number on the back of the domino versus what was on the actual dominoes themselves. And you don't have any of that in King Domino Duel because you're rolling dice.
Yeah, it's really highly dependent on the dice roll and whether it's your turn to roll or not when the stuff comes up that you want.
Plus this added complexity of the spellbook. Look, your main goal is still to maximize your points with X's and shields to make high-value domains. But you also have to pay attention to your opponent's kingdom, because if they're getting too close to getting some of those one-time use spells, it could really tip the balance on one side or the other. Sometimes it'll actually make more sense to take a die that doesn't really help you that much just to prevent your opponent from getting it. Classic hate drafting. But in this game, it's actually really important.
Because it's a two-person game.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is a roll and write. As is common, we found ourselves wishing for erasers probably once a game. Honestly, this was actually a really good giveaway at conventions because they were giving away King Domino erasers, but it probably would have been better if there was one in the box.
Yeah, I think we'll probably just throw one in the box for future use.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You definitely could pack this game into a little zip-top baggie to fit easily into a purse or even into a pocket.
Yeah, we've done that.
But the box does a pretty good job of keeping everything ready and at your fingertips. I do really like the cleverness of how this game makes use of both sides of the paper. One side of every sheet shows a blank kingdom. The other side shows the spellbook. And in a normal game, you use two kingdoms and one spellbook. This means that there's going to be some reuse of paper, maybe not a perfect reuse. You're not using both sides of every single sheet.
But it's better than it could be.
Yeah, and it's a clever way to expand out and have more sheets of paper on the table without just being really wasteful.
This is a game where the more we played it, the more we appreciated it. It's definitely filling a different niche than its predecessor. King Domino is definitely a game that's a casual filler game that you can play with your kids, things like that. I don't really feel that way about this one. But it is compact, it's quick, it's pretty easy to save state. If necessary, you just have to take a note on whose turn it is to roll. It's a great game to bring on a date. This is a game that we've brought on lunch dates a bunch of times.
Yes.
Anytime you have 15 minutes to play a game, you can play King Domino Duel. It takes up almost no room.
Although I wouldn't play this with younger kids, the recommendation on the box is ages 8 and up. I'd say that's just about right. Younger kids are great at King Domino, but they'll have trouble splitting their attention between the spellbook, their kingdom, and their opponent's kingdom in King Domino Duel.
You could probably modify the game to just ignore the spellbook to play with younger kids.
Sure.
That would probably be okay.
Sure.
So I think that's about it on King Domino Duel. How would we rate this game, Anitra?
I think we would rate it 4 out of 5 coats of arms.
I agree. And that's King Domino Duel.
In a snap.
And we're back.
So, this week has been interesting.
I think it's been interesting for a lot of people. A
whole lot of people.
I think teachers are getting a raise in 2020.
I bet a lot of teachers are, yeah. So, personally, I have a lot of homeschooling friends. I've even considered the idea of homeschooling one of our children in the past. But even with all of that, I was still totally unprepared for homeschooling 3 children starting a week ago.
Yep. So was the public school system, for what it's worth.
Yeah, in most places, it totally was. So we have some tips, some that I've gleaned from listening to other people, doing some research, also from my own experience. And the first thing I want to tell you is, if you are freaking out about homeschooling your kids right now, don't freak out. They're not going to fall behind, at least not nearly as quickly as you think they are. Every kid is in the same boat right now. And the most important thing is to keep your kids sane. Or whatever semblance of that you can do, because my kids are kind of insane all the time.
Our kids are pretty good. Don't let them hear me say that, but they're pretty good.
Next, I've done enough research into alternate forms of schooling to know that most elementary school kids only actually need about 1 hour of instruction or academic activity a day. Our schools are set up to do a lot more than that, but that's about all they actually retain. Sorry, guys. So don't feel bad if you can't fill the whole day with stuff.
Yeah, I would say that a lot of our homeschooling friends probably spend between 3 to 4 hours doing various school-related things in a given day.
Yeah, it depends a lot on how many kids they have and the age of those kids.
Mm-hmm.
Because middle schoolers and high schoolers do need more time. Most middle schoolers need 2 to 3 hours, and high schoolers, it's a little bit more than that. But think of homeschooling more like a college course. Most college courses figure that 2 hours of instruction a week is enough, and then the kids, the young adults, are expected to go off and do the rest of the learning on their own. Third piece of encouragement for you. Education, homeschooling, does not have to be about textbooks and worksheets and flashcards and instructional videos. It's fine to use those if they work for you and for your kid. But if they don't, that's okay. That's part of what we're going to talk about today.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about the alternatives to the more traditional schooly things that we think about. Reading. Reading is super important. Read with your kids, read to your kids, have them read to you. Reading. So much reading.
All of the reading.
Find whatever interests them for them to read, especially once they hit third, fourth grade and up.
Reading is really one of those things that a homeschool context actually is much better for, I think, than a public school context, because there's such a wide difference, especially at younger ages.
Oh, yeah.
In the amount that a kid can handle in reading a book.
Yeah, well, and I can use our own kids as examples. Kids just learn how to read at different speeds and at different times and with different aptitudes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Our oldest was reading chapter books when she was 4 and a half.
Which is insane.
Like, in preschool.
It's crazy.
Like, crazy.
It's crazy.
Asher, our middle child, really wasn't reading confidently until he was 7?
Yeah, I think that sounds about right. But now he's a complete bookworm.
Yeah, now he's a complete bookworm. Right. But I was reassured by his teacher even then at like 6 and a half. This is still normal.
Mm-hmm.
This is still totally in the normal range.
And now he's getting in trouble for not paying attention during reading
because he's
at school because he's reading ahead and all of these things. So,
well,
yeah.
He won't get in trouble for that at home.
Right. Well, that's exactly my point, though, is we can watch him and make sure that he's retaining that information, even though he's reading faster than, air quote, normal, because we don't have a classroom full of 35 kids.
Yeah.
Right? So that's why I say that it's a better environment for reading than public school is, which is not to knock public schools. Like, that's not what I'm trying
to do. It's also why I'm saying find whatever your kid is really interested in reading. I have tons of anecdotes about this that I've heard second and third hand, but it really doesn't matter what they're reading as long as they're reading. So back of the cereal box, fine. Comic books, fine. If they think that picture books are for little babies and they would much rather read chapter books and you feel like those are too hard, let them try.
Mm-hmm.
And if it is really too hard, then either find easier chapter books for them or work with them on techniques for how to learn the words as they go. I will share one anecdote from one of my favorite books about learning by a guy named John Holt called Learning All the Time. And he was working with like a GED class, basically. And this 16 or 17 year old kid stands up with the biography of Malcolm X and basically said, why didn't anybody ever tell me that books like this existed? And up until that summer that he was in summer school, GED, whatever it was, he basically would have been considered to have like a second grade reading level.
Well, this goes back to what I said before. Remember, I was talking about the difference between playing something because you have to and playing something because you want to versus reading something because you have to
right.
and reading something because you want to.
Right.
Just the engagement that our kids have with something when they get to choose what it is, it drives them to try harder to understand the material.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know your kid, you know what they're interested in. If you're like us, it's probably harder to get to your local library right now, but take a look at what other kinds of resources are out there, what you can buy from Amazon, what you can borrow from somebody else.
Disinfect it, of course.
Disinfect. Yeah, leave it outside for a couple of days and then disinfect it.
Everybody in the future is going to have a disinfectant box that it's just like in front of their door.
We totally are.
Yeah.
But really pay attention to what lights them up, what they're interested in, and try to give them resources that go along with that for reading.
There are so many games out there that have a reading component to them. I think of games like Above and Below or
yeah.
Near and Far, where there's an extremely strong narrative element to these games. And the conceit in a game like that is that you're passing the book around so that somebody who is not the active player is doing the reading. And so there's stuff happening and everybody gets to play, but a huge component of that game is the reading part. And so I'm going to use this to segue into other things like math and probability, because these are games where you have to make a decision and you've got to look at, when you roll the dice, what your probable numbers are, but it's all initially being driven by someone reading something.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The other thing that's nice about this is because it's a passive player in the game who's doing the reading at any given time, you're engaging different parts of your brain. You are reading while I'm trying to figure out probability because I'm the active player,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And then it switches, and now I'm reading, and you're trying to figure out probability. But this is an opportunity for me to put the book down if you're one of my kids who struggles with probability or is learning it or whatever, and say, okay, let's talk about the numbers without saying, dude, you really want to do this because the numbers are bad.
Yeah.
I can let you make that decision, but I can give you the relevant information. So there's reading happening, and at a separate time in the same game, there's math happening.
Mm-hmm.
And that gets into math, which is, I mean, all the math. Every game's got math.
I mean, math is everywhere, mm-hmm. but math is in every game. If you have elementary school kids like I do, I will highly recommend an exercise that I did with them this past week, which was to give them two dice and have them roll the two dice 100 times and just chart it out on a chart from 2 to 12. That is a very visual way for them to start to see how probability works.
Now, you were talking about a really cool example that you had recounted on a BGG thread about the difference in probability between flipping cards and rolling dice.
Yeah, so maybe I'll link to this, but there was a BGG thread that I commented on that had the parent of a 14-year-old saying, my 14-year-old wants to put more fun into his schooling. What games do we have that I could count as educational?
And like included a picture of his games?
Well, it's BGG, so you can click through to their profile and see all the games they have listed. So in looking at what they had, I said, use something like zombie dice or Yahtzee to work out the probability of any given combination. Roll for It is also great for this.
Mm-hmm.
But then if you have a middle schooler or high schooler, then have them compare it to a game like Sushi Go or even a deck of cards if you don't have Sushi Go and say, okay, what's the probability of drawing such and such a card? Well, now that you've drawn a card, or if it's Sushi Go, now that somebody else has drawn cards and you know we're passing, how many cards are left now? What's the probability of drawing a card like that now? So I think that's a really interesting way to introduce probability at a level that kids can understand.
And hopefully at a level that kids are at least a little bit more interested in.
Right. As long as I'm talking about that thread. You can use other games that are not inherently academic or educational as jumping off points for exercises that would be. So a game like Parks. Okay, we've played Parks, but let's look at all of the park cards here. Where are all these parks around the United States? Or you could even play, I'm sorry, Pandemic or any other game with a world map. Spymaster, I suppose, that has a world map too. And start using that to talk about the different continents and how things do move from place to place. And honestly, if you have an older kid, yes, draw them into it and talk about these are places that have been hit earlier or harder with COVID-19 versus these places. Why do you think that is? Are there more routes into and out of those places? What do you see on this map?
And then, of course, you mentioned 10 Days in the USA.
Yeah, I mean, 10 Days in the USA, just it sits on our shelf and then... Much like Teist, it's one of those games that comes out every once in a while like, yeah, we want to play this. And it really does reward a combination of puzzle-solving thinking and a really solid knowledge of where all the states are. I mean, you've got a map in front of you, but it's still better if you're not constantly referring back to it to say, wait, is this state next to this one? Or is it one state away?
Absolutely. And... You know, there's other games that can certainly help out in other realms as well. So we think about science games. So I'm going to go on a limb here. We have this game that we've talked about before called Champion of the Wild.
Okay.
This game is whacked. Okay. It's crazy. You have to take an animal and you have to negotiate with everybody else about how your animal is the best at a ridiculous triathlon.
Mm-hmm,
And the things in the triathlon could be anything like dance performances to supermarket sweep to like the 50-yard dash, things
right.
like this.
Popping a room full of balloons.
Yeah, whatever. But here's the thing. You really have to get creative when thinking about these animals and all of the things that they can or cannot do in order to make these arguments.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that really leads itself into a genuinely interesting discussion of why it is that these animals have these features.
Are like that, yeah.
Yeah. And if you look at a bunch of, I don't know, water creatures... You're going to notice some similarities versus a bunch of mammals that live in cold areas or mammals that don't live in cold areas. And so you can really have some great discussions with your kids that are kind of silly, because let's face it, this game is not serious.
Champion of the Wild taken to its educational endpoint makes me think that it's like the wackiest episode ever of Wild Kratts.
I mean, sure. I think it's like the Animal Planet version of one of those crazy Japanese game shows.
But on the Wild Kratts TV show, which we've been watching more of lately, shock, surprise, they always talk about things that make a specific animal special traits they have that are unlike other animals, whether that's camouflage or spikes or marsupials carry their babies in a pouch on their belly, anything like that.
So they obviously would be good at Supermarket Sweep.
Yeah.
And they can jump up and get things off the highest shelf.
Right,
because they
exactly.
have powerful legs.
Well, kangaroos.
Sure.
Not all marsupials are kangaroos. Right.
But these are the kinds of ridiculous and silly conversations actually lead to meaningful conversation about the features of these animals.
Yeah, exactly. And may spark interest to go find out more. There are more obvious contenders for games that teach. Plenty of science games. Our favorites are mostly from Genius Games, although What in the Wild from the Michigan Department of Natural Resources is excellent.
Excellent game, yep.
And Viral by Arcane Wonders is also quite good.
Yeah, I don't know how educational Viral is, other than it, I suppose, shows you parts of the human body.
I mean, yeah, it's parts of the human body. It's the circulatory system. A lot of the special cards are going to teach you more about human biology.
Okay, sure. I can get behind that. But you're right. I mean, Genius Games, basically everything they release is very educational. They have a new math game that I saw at Toy Fair that is really about speed arithmetic, which I'm a fan of.
I'm terrible at.
Yeah. But okay, all of you playing at home, this is an example of God putting opposites together. In math, it could not be more obvious that we have exactly the opposite sets of skills.
Yeah, neither one of us is bad at math, per se. It's just that our strengths lie in different areas.
My strengths lie with numbers. Your strengths lie with letters.
My strengths lie with the abstract concepts.
Yeah.
Yes.
Derivatives and integrals. Ugh. But you give me arithmetic all day long. Anyway, so that is math games, science games, geography stuff.
So let's see, what else can we talk about that isn't going to feel like a chore? History.
Yeah, so the first game that comes to mind for me, honestly, is Order of Invention.
Yeah, honestly, that's a super light, super easy game, but the inventions range from, I think, the 1800s through present day.
It is shocking how old some things are.
But even for something a little bit heavier, we've talked a little bit about games that are historical or history adjacent before. Things like Discoveries,
yep,
the Adventures
of
Lewis and Clark.
Yep. World's Fair 1893.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Or even things like Ticket to Ride or Colt Express, the age of railways and why that's important.
How about Tesla versus Edison?
Well, obviously.
I mean, come on.
I mean, but I'm also the daughter of a scientist.
Yeah.
So... yeah.
One of the things I love about Tesla versus Edison is that every single card has some flavor text on it that is teaching you more stuff about all those crazy things that happened. And some of it is wild. And we went on a date and watched the current war.
Yeah.
And we saw some of those same things. It was nuts, man.
Electrocuting a horse.
Oh, craziness.
All kinds of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
All right. So we've talked about math. We've talked about reading. We've talked about science and history and geography. How about writing?
The first game that comes to mind when I think about writing and games is Poetry Slam.
Right. So I think Poetry Slam has this to recommend it, for sure.
Absolutely. This is a game where your primary goal is to develop limericks that give hints to certain words.
So first you come up with a word that fits the restrictions,
mm-hmm.
and then you have to come up with a rhyming couplet.
Oh, excuse me, not a limerick.
Not a limerick.
Limericks are the best kinds of rhyming couplets.
Limericks are not rhyming couplets.
Eh, whatever.
Limericks are AA.
It was St. Patrick's Day last week. I'm talking about limericks right now. Yeah, what? Anyway, okay, no. You are supposed to come up with a rhyming couplet that is a hint for the word that you have come up with that fits the restrictions that the board is giving you.
Yeah, and as we've mentioned back when we reviewed Poetry Slam, there's also an element of cooperation in here that you want to give points to other people for simply making good rhymes, even if you didn't guess what their word was.
I think one of the most fun times I ever had playing Poetry Slam was listening to the rhyming couplets that Claire came up with.
Yeah.
Our now 11-year-old. She was,
I think she was 10 at the time.
At the time? I don't know. I think it was maybe last summer?
So
I don't remember. Anyway, I was genuinely impressed with some of the stuff she came up with.
I will say that unless your kids are super precocious, 10 years old is just about the lower bound. You probably don't want to go much younger.
Yeah, you probably don't.
However, it's a way to talk about writing and poetry and spelling skills for those a little bit older kids in a less threatening, you know, more fun kind of way.
So let's talk about other games that would help with writing and creative writing. The classic example here has got to be RPGs.
Yeah, any kind
of
RPG.
The encouragement of taking one of these RPGs and writing a backstory for your character.
Yeah, or writing the further adventures of...
Yeah, or anything like that, where you're playing, there's a game being played, but you don't necessarily have to, and I think this is really a big thing about this whole idea of games and education, you don't have to perform the act of educating your child at the same time that the game is happening.
Mm-hmm,
it can be adjacent to the game. And so when we talk about writing, we talk about a role-playing game. Let's say your kid is really into, I don't know, a younger kid is really into My Little Pony. There is a My Little Pony RPG.
There's also No Thank You Evil,
yeah,
which you can play with whatever characters your kids like.
Mm-hmm. But whatever that topic is, you can find something that will support it. Go to drivethroughrpg.com.
Mm-hmm.
You can find something. I pretty much guarantee it. And then take that and play a little bit with that with your kids. And then be like, all right, you know what? Tell me a story about what, I don't know, Tinker did before or after this quest happened or something like that. Just write something out and you've got some creative writing practice.
Yep. My last recommendation on this one would be Untold.
Yep. Which, I thought about Untold, you know, as we were going through this.
It is this very, very free-form role-playing game, but there are episode sheets right in there and you could have your kid who you're playing this game with say, okay, well, now that we went through and did our whole episode, please give me a plot summary.
Or you could even record it, you know, and have
tell
them
me, tell me
start
what we
with
did.
A transcription and then fill in the blanks and see what you get. Untold is really fun like that because you don't have to really follow much of anything. You can just kind of whatever comes off the top of your head and it's pretty silly and kind of a blast. This is the kind of game where in 20 years, we're going to be reading some book and you'd be like, well, I first learned how to tell stories by playing these games with my, you know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
That's the kind of thing. Because I think now you hear these stories of these people who really loved books. And so they would make believe with their kids. And so their kids turned out to be C.S. Lewis. It's just, how it works out.
In modern times, let's say it's things like kids who grew up reading comic books and now are authors and illustrators themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Or grew up playing D&D and ended up turning their D&D campaign into a whole series of novels. Dragonlance. But I think you're right. I think we'll hear more of that in the future. Let's swing back a little bit to younger kids. I want to remind you, we talk about it a lot incidentally on this show, but all games are educational. Every single game.
Mm-hmm.
Kids are learning to take turns. Kids are learning to deal with the emotions they feel as they're winning or losing. They learn fine motor skills or gross motor skills or both, depending on the game. If you've got kids that are first grade and under, all you need to do with them is do some reading and some real basic math and then fine motor skills, gross motor skills. It's more important that they learn how to take turns, that they learn how to not get their way, than it is for them to be reading novels or doing math worksheets or anything like that.
I completely agree. And we talked a little bit, was it two shows ago, about Play This, Not That with replacements for Candyland. And our examples were both Monza and Hiss, which are really focused at that level. I think that's pretty much going to wrap it up for us. I have one more super exciting piece of news for everybody.
Okay.
So we at The Family Gamers are working with our sponsor, First Move Financial, and with a small company you may or may not have heard of called Haba.
Ooh.
And we are going to do a bunch of giveaways.
Yeah, we want to get more games into your hands, especially because you might find it very hard to go out to your friendly local game store right now.
That's true. So we're going to have some fulfillment question marks because the warehouse for Haba is in New York, which is currently under lockdown.
Complete lockdown.
But what we want to do is we would like to give away, working with Haba and working with First Move Financial, some of the games that we are talking about in our educational game series that we're releasing on Wednesdays right now.
Yes. So as of this recording, we've currently talked about why learning through games is important with Chrissy.
Mm-hmm.
And Chrissy also wrote an essay talking about Animal Upon Animal, The crest climbers.
Yes.
And how that is great for teaching not just turn taking and motor skills, but also physics and discernment or critical thinking.
At basically an elementary school level.
Yeah.
So what we would like to do is give away a copy of Animal Upon Animal Crest Climbers.
So when you're hearing this, check out our website and we will have the giveaway posted front and center, easy for you to get to.
That's right. We're going to use our standard giveaway widget, but also one thing we're going to include in there is I want to know how you are playing games with your kids in a way that is helping them educationally. During this whole crazy, insane thing, we would love to hear from each and every one of you. Head over to our Facebook community. The easiest way is if you go to thefamilygamers.com and you enter that contest, just go to thefamilygamers.com/community to head over to our Facebook community. We would love to hear some of the games that you are playing with your kids and trying to teach them a little bit. thefamilygamers.com/community. If you don't want to go to the community, you'd rather just talk to us on standard social media, you can do that by going to @FamilyGamersAA on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
Or you can, as always, send us an email. Anitra@thefamilygamers.com.
Andrew@thefamilygamers.com.
Please don't forget to subscribe to this podcast and tell your friends about it, especially if they're also stuck home with their kids.
That's right. And you can also tell people that aren't your friends about it by leaving us a review at Apple Podcast or whatever your podcast subscription source is. You can find us on Spotify, TuneIn, Stitcher, all of those things. This episode of the Family Gamers Podcast is generously sponsored by First Move Financial. Go to firstmovefinancial.com/familygamers to learn how the team at First Move Financial can help you get past your financial analysis paralysis and make your next move.
Thank you, First Move Financial. Well, I think that's going to be it for us this week. Until next week,
play games with your kids.